Good evening, this is Dr. Dan Guerra, Authentic Biochemistry Podcast. Today is actually the 21st of February, 2024. Well, while the fire is crackling in the wood stove, I am going to do chapter number 12 in our very first mosaic, which is still about phosphatic acid, phosphatase, but it's going to take a new turn. We're leaving behind that whole discussion, because I promised that, on the inner mitochondrial membrane and the protease and mTORC. I don't think we're going to come back to that at all, and yet we will finish the mosaic. So I have a few more lectures left that I wrote that I think are very important to cover, and that's what I am going to do. So back up a little bit. We mentioned recently this whole process of secretion. And I think I even brought up again one of our old friends, the porosome. So I want to go back and cover that a bit. And then I'm going to bring back, of course, the phospholipid coordinate of that process that allows for secretion. So secretion is responsible, and indeed it's required, for many physiological activities. And they include the immune response, which is, of course, huge, but also the release of hormones, digestive enzymes, and indeed the other large physiological response, neurotransmission. So there are components of all of those physiological issues where secretory vesicles completely merge with the cell plasma membrane during the secretory process. And of course, that results in the release of the contents. But a little bit over, getting about 30 years ago now, under a microscopy, it was observed that there some of these vesicles, secretory vesicles, that had granules, which could be things like polypeptides, didn't completely empty. So you had partially filled secretory vesicles. Now, we mentioned that briefly in one of those lectures. I guess that might have been earlier this week or last week. And so if you have partially empty vesicles, what causes that? What happens to the content? And what's going on at the membrane interface? And overall, is that still a mechanism of the secretory pathway? So you have to think about the quanta of cargo secretion. And is there a qualitative or simply a quantitative measure of that quanta that will be secreted? And what's the mechanism for that? And then think about the maintenance of the secretory vesicles. So the other mechanism that seems to obtain involves a plasma membrane structure called the porosome. And that what that does is serve to prevent what would be expected once a vesicle was emptied. And that's because of the high surface tension of the secretory vesicle membrane, which would otherwise result in a complete collapse of the vesicle within the cell membrane. So that might be tolerated, but as a lipid biochemist, I would think that would make a massive alteration of the endomembranous component of that secretory membrane. And how would that get resolved? So this is in the membrane lipid raft being generated de novo with the help of the mitochondrial endoplasmic reticulum, Golgi apparatus carrying out a synthesis of, say, plasmalogens or ceramide to be able to lock in, or cholesterol, to be able to lock in to a plasma membrane, carrying with it protein content, cargo that is, that can fuse into that system, remain there, and then carry out communication external to internal. Now, this is fusion with vesicles, which nevertheless is highly regulated. But if you're leaving behind vesicular remnants in the membrane, it seems to me that would be a very more, that would be something would have to be resolved, okay, biochemically resolved within that membrane. So looks like these porosomes kind of take care of that issue. So they are a domain in the membrane that allows for this regular vesicular trafficking that includes an incomplete release of the contents, or otherwise known as granules. So in acinar cells, I know you remember those because I talked about them. And remember, acinar cells are a component of the exocrine pancreas. And there you find partially filled zymogen granules. And those are indeed the secretory vesicles of those acinar cells. And they're generated following a secretory event. And this can all be caught in electron microscopy. And what, when it is, it showed intracellularly located zymogen granules in the pancreatic acinar cells. And what's interesting is when that secretion occurred, there was a maintenance of the numerical consort of these zymogen granules that appeared to remain unchanged even after secretion was over. So that's curious, right? Why would the number be maintained? Well, that means that those vesicles didn't collapse. At least that would be a mechanism to give you that result, right? So obviously there's an increase in the number of empty or partially empty vesicles following a secretory event. So going with a new technique at the time, which was atomic force microscopy, or AFM, they looked at docked ZGs, zymogen granules, at these acinar cells, at the apical plasma membrane in live pancreatic acinar, following a physiological stimulation for cell secretion. And what they were using was a cholecystokinin analog called carbamylcholine. Okay. And now, and the reason they use an analog and not CCK8 itself is because CCK8 itself would turn over. So they could better regulate the process by adding a certain amount of carbamylcholine and then titrate the entire process. And what they see is first in the zymogen granules, a swelling. And the swelling seems to be immediately proximal to cell secretion. Then that's followed by what's known as an intravesicular content release and consequent decrease in ZG volume, which of course is all very canonical. And but that volume and the number of partially emptied ZGs remains long after the measured secretory event. So there's a reason for those vesicles to be hanging around, right? So what's the structure that enables this sort of transient secretory vesicle fusion and then a regulated fractional release of the intravesicular contents from the cells during secretion? It's an obvious question. Cell biology question, really. So the molecular event at the membrane has to be energetically overcome, because what you have to overcome is the surface tension of the vesicle membrane. Otherwise, you can't prevent the collapse of the vesicle at the contact point with the plasma membrane. So this porosome, now we know, is a supramolecular lipoprotein structure, event structure, at the cell membrane. And it's very commonly found in all cells. So it's considered the universal secretory portal in cells. Porosomes are indeed cup-shaped lipoprotein structures. Again, you find them at the plasma membrane, and it's where membrane-bound secretory vesicles transiently dock, fuse, and then release their intravesicular content to the outside of the cell during the secretory process. So you might think this is just simply a fusion pore, but a fusion pore is a continuity established between two fusing membranes. And it's there, all right, in this process of the porosome. In fact, it develops that pore at the porosomal base, where the secretory vesicle membrane actually carries out its fusion. So during secretion, secretory vesicles transiently dock and fuse at the base of the porosome cup via proteins called snares. And thus, they establish that fusion pore, or essentially continuity, between the secretory vesicle membrane and the porosomal base. And the event it obtains, apparently, is precisely measured, because you get a quanta of release of intravesicular contents that occurs immediately prior to vesicular fusion at the porosome. So secretory vesicles swell via a regulated active transport of H2O and, of course, ions, and the resultant intravesicular pressure generated from that process drives the intravesicular contents to the outside. That occurs without compromising the integrity of either the vesicular membrane or, of course, the plasma lemma. Okay. So this porosome disallows the collapse of the secretory vesicle. And so it transiently fuses with the plasma membrane and then expels that portion of its contents, and there's a disengagement, okay? Now, porosomes themselves range in size from 15 nanometers in neurons and astrocytes in the CNS to well over 180 nanometers in the exocrine cells and also in endocrine cells, because they're secretory, right? So neuronal porosomes are composed of only about 40 proteins, and compare that to the simplified nuclear pore complex, which is composed of over 500 protein molecular species. So it's a much tighter proteome. Maybe that is why it has higher integrity, because the turnover of those proteins is going to be more temporally regulated, right? Possible. Now, there are coordinated molecular assemblies of the membrane-associated transport snare and the vesicular snare proteins. Now, I've gone over this before in lecture, not recently, but that what that generates is a rosette complex. And you can see this in EM. And that results in the establishment of this essential membrane continuity forming that fusion pore, again, at the base of the porosome. And it surprises me when I think about it, because I remember when this literature was first coming out, because I was a professor, and I brought this into my membrane course. But this whole process has only been discovered since really well established since the new millennia. And in these last, 25 years or so, we have got a completely updated molecular understanding of cellular secretion. And that's generated a huge paradigm shift in what's going on with cell communication. So finally, we get to the lipids. Phosphatidic acid is, of course, a fusogenic lipid. It directly binds to the polybasic juxtamembrane region with a protein called syntaxin 1A. We talked about this earlier in this mosaic. So syntaxin 1A mutations, which are developed that progressively reduce lipid binding, result in a progressive loss of secretion, fidelity, and integrity. Now, beyond that, overexpression of the phosphatidic acid generating enzyme known as phospholipase D rescues the secretory defect of the protein mutation. So isn't that curious? So syntaxin 1A is one of the neuronal porosomal polypeptides that appears to be associated with phosphatidic acid-induced porosomal secretion. Okay? Syntaxin 1A clustering then is mediated, as it turns out. These are papers published. Now, I'm giving you lecture notes here, but these are papers published, probably 15 years ago. But syntaxin, maybe more recently, maybe 10 years ago. Syntaxin 1A clustering is mediated by an electrostatic interaction with other phospholipids, including the very strong anionic lipid phosphatidylinositol 4,5 bisphosphate. And in fact, or PIP2, right? So the enriched presence of PIP2 in the neuronal porosome complex associates then a specific complex that confirms that overall rapid secretory process in the CNS. So the current understanding is that the binding of isolated neuronal porosome to phosphatidic acid, cardiolipin, phosphatidylinositol phosphate, phosphatidylinositol bisphosphate, and then inositol trisphosphate occurs in increasing order of strength. Okay. As you add more phosphate to that phospholipid, you get a stronger binding. Okay. But phosphatidic acid is a fusogenic lipid, but fusogenesis isn't the same as the completion of secretion, say, where these other lipids may play a more significant role. So all the membrane proteins are basically salvated by a shell of lipid molecules. And those lipid molecules interact with the membrane penetrating surface of the protein. And those lipids have a name. They're called the annular lipids. So lipid molecules are also found between the transmembrane alpha helical structures of those membrane proteins within the bilayer. Those are not the annular lipids. Those are the non-annular lipids. Okay, but they're ordered with the polypeptide chain and in association with the sterol backbone. Remember that. When they're associated just with the sterol backbone, the cyclopentanophenanthrene ring I talk about, then that turns more into a water channel. But there are polypeptides there. It's a totally different domain of the protein. Okay? And that protein that is involved in that process generates a membrane-organized domain of proteolipid. See? And part of that arrives via lipid membrane raft, which requires ceramide and cholesterol, 1-to-1 ratio. Remember that? Now, annular lipid binding is dependent on the fatty acyl chain length. And that suggests, obviously, a hydrophobic marriage between the membrane protein and the surrounding lipid bilayer, if it indeed is a lipid bilayer, or some kind of disturbed non-bilayer, right? And what that will generate is a physical distortion on the alpha helical bundle associated with the membrane polypeptide. So it makes sense. So it's been demonstrated that annular lipids actually readily exchange with bulk bilayer lipids. So I told you this is a tremendously dynamic system, the membrane. Okay? Now, what's that exchange resulting in? the movement of those polypeptides and what we used to call way back in the day capping of proteins in the membrane, particularly in the plasma membrane. Okay. Now, those are the annular. The non-annular lipids seem to be somewhat restricted. And what is restricting them? The cholesterol, because you're getting ordering of the acyl chains, you see? So there is a symphony with a dance sequence when you think about the precise interaction between proteins and lipids, which are going to be influence each other in the membrane structural event domain. Okay? And prior to what's carried out during the communication process is going to be the formation and the maintenance of those domains, right? Formation has to be just right, and then that domain has to be maintained, and then it has to carry out the process. What we're talking about here is the porosomal secretory process. Of course, many other things are happening in the membrane. Right? Signal transduction cascades, for example. So, let's continue. Let's just say there's a significant contribution to cellular and subcellular events that are imparted by proteins that cross-link actin or that otherwise connect actin filaments to the cellular membrane. Now, protein that comes in front and center here is the spectrin superfamily. They're considered cytoskeletal polypeptides. And of course, they include proteins like spectrin beta and dystrophin. Those are known neuronal porosomal polypeptides. And those proteins have a specific domain, and it's called the plextrin homology domain, or the pH, remember. And that domain binds lipids, and it serves as a membrane anchoring device. Now, pH repeats are each composed of some 120 amino acids, and to their basic residues, phosphates of phosphoinositides of various molecular species, PI45P2, PI345P3, PI35P2, and inositol 145P3, all bind to those pH, those plextrin homology domains on those polypeptides, which are indeed part of the spectrin superfamily, including spectrin beta and dystrophin. Porosomal complex now starting to appear before your very eyes. So the presence of phosphoinositol bisphosphate, PIP2, in the porosomal complex and the lipid binding studies that followed along the study of porosomal secretion processes allowed for a series of hypotheses to be generated about protein-lipid interactions within the neuronal porosomal complex. And all of that ultimately supported an hypothesis that required an interaction of phosphatidic acid, PA, and those phosphoinositol lipids with the protein syntaxin 1A. And that those phosphatidic acid, phosphoinositols, and syntaxin 1A were intimately involved in cell secretory responses. Okay? So this is where it started coming together. Now, let's talk about a particular amino acid, which is actually also an excitatory neurotransmitter, glutamate. The release of glutamate following phosphatidic acid exposure was a study done in the mammalian brain excitatory neurotransmitter complex in culture. Okay? And in fact, that PA is associated with glutamate secretion that is indeed a predominant excitatory neurotransmission in the mammalian brain. So the first studies had determined if phosphatic acid exposure resulted in some kind of alteration of neuronal function. So this was back in the days where they took rat brain slices and subjected them to 2 hours exposure to simply 5 micromolar phosphatidic acid. Then they assessed the ability of those neuronal fractions to release glutamate upon stimulation using potassium chloride. It's ionically driven, as you know. So the results of the studies demonstrated that there was a 3-fold increase in glutamic acid release at the earliest time point, which was about 10 minutes into the study. Then it plateaued at later time points because of what's called the high affinity glutamate transporter saturation kinetics. Therefore, that reduced extracellular glutamate, which, as you know, can cause glutaminotoxicity at high concentrations. So not only that blockage of glutamate toxicity occurring, that plateau occurring, you also get a concomitant increase now coming on from the GABAergic inhibitory synaptic function. Okay. So you see how this whole thing works perfectly with excitatory, inhibitory neurotransmission. And it seems that phosphatidic acid is essential for this to occur. Okay. So phosphatidic acid then is a good candidate lipid species that directly allows glutamate release at the metabolomic synapse. In fact, phosphatidic acid is coincidental with glutamate release. So that was the first real eye-opener that showed that ionic lipids, because PA is ionic, play some kind of role in the porosomal-mediated neurotransmitter release. Okay, and this can be titrated. Titrated with phosphatidic acid, both concentration and temporally. And it was indeed titrated and compared to non-ionic, particularly non-anionic lipids, which had no effect on the whole secretory process. So that right away told us something about the process. Okay. So let me see where I'm at on time here, because I don't want to overload you. Oh yeah, let's stop there. So we finally got to phosphatidic acid. Now remember, the phosphatidic acid phosphohydrolase, so the lipin 1 or phosphatidic acid phosphatase, all three of the same protein, are going to play a very significant role, right? Because if diacylglycerol is generated phosphatidic acid, here you have a very powerful alteration of the mediation of glutamate secretion in the CNS, and possibly also in endocrine systems, where there are other secretory properties going, secretory vesicles with different cargo. And so you have both endocrine systems and exocrine systems, which all can fall under the umbrella. All now we can start focusing back at phosphatidic acid or other anionic lipids and any of the enzymes that function to deliver their synthesis. They're swapping out with other polar head groups and or ultimately their utilization in other lipid metabolic pathways, such as the generation of diacylglycerol for all the other phospholipids that play a role. Dr. Dan Guerra, biochemistry, on this Wednesday night, bidding you having a good night and bye for now.